moved last Thursday.
Well, actually, I was born in Tacoma and raised in Tacoma. I went to school in Tacoma. The way I happened to get involved in the waterfront was during the Depression. I went to work for Puget Sound Egg Packers. And the foreman there, a fellow by the name of Baxter Collins, him and I got to be pretty good friends. And of course it was more or less seasonal, and but the August or September they'd lay you off because they'd pack all their eggs in the summertime and mm-hmm. put them in storage.
How old were you when you started doing this?
I was about 20, 21, 22. Mm-hmm. And so the next year, and then finally we got on WPA, we had to do something. And they called me back again in the spring mm-hmm. of 35. And the same thing materialized. You keep busy. In fact, I worked nights there with a bunch for a while. And then this Baxter Collin, they used to send a crew over from Seattle. See, Schaefer number 2 had salmon in it, mm-hmm. cases of salmon, unlabeled. And they would get orders, and then they'd have a crew come over, and they'd put the labels on, and they'd load them right into boxcars or whatever was necessary. Mm-hmm. So then they turned around and this Lester Weymouth from Puyallup had been in the packing business at one time or another, and he contracted to do this work. Well, they had to have union men, so we applied for a charter through Patty Morris, mm-hmm. and there were 10 men, or 8 men and 2 women. They used to have some hand labeling, and the women would do the hand labeling, and the other was done by machine. And the 10 men that we had were Joe Valenda, Fred Seal, Baxter Collins, Tommy Thomas, James Glenn, Harvey Jorgensen, and myself. And the 2 women were Clary Kroll and Carol Thomas, or Dolly Thomas, rather. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way it was. And then in the spring of 36, one member dropped out, and we got my brother in there. Well, we got a little hell from the hall for putting a man in without notifying them. But anyway, this is the way we got started. And then in 36, we would, when we weren't working on the docks, we'd go down to the hall and get extra work. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got started on longshoring.
You had your own separate local, though, with these 12 people.
Yes, it was 38-122. In fact, I was the president of the local at one time. Mm-hmm. And then Tommy Thomas. But they were, the majority of them had been in the valley that had worked around the canneries in Puyallup and around Puyallup and Sumner. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'd done a little nailing and things when I worked for Carstein's here when I was going to high school. Mm-hmm. So that's how I happened to be at Puget Sound Egg Packers. We used to have to recuper the some of the wooden cases, and we'd have to do some nailing on them. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of nailing on wooden cases there, and there were also cardboard cases. But the supply would come in the summertime, and then through the year, you could turn around and send shipments out.
What, you would label them according to who the consignee was? There'd be a brand name,
right?
Several brand names.
Oh, yes, and a lot of it would go to England. Mm-hmm. A lot of the salmon went to England. The ones that were in wooden cases usually went to England. They'd be loaded aboard ship. But a lot of them just went out in rail cars here, distributed among the United States.
Yeah. Now, your local, that local didn't exist for very long.
That existed until they absorbed us, and actually our transfers were submitted in September 17th of 1940. And we were accepted in the local, transferred over into the local in October of 1940.
Now, what had happened with salmon labeling it?
They discontinued bringing them in here. There were no more cartons of salmon or cases of salmon came in. They started going Seattle and Bellingham. I think the majority of it is up in Bellingham now. A lot of it is being done right up in Alaska.
Yeah.
So it's just it was just a case of no work. So we had gone through the little strike that we had in the spring of 1940.
Yeah, I saw some references to that.
Yeah.
Was it just a basic, you know, wages?
Well, no, that
strike,
was we wanted our bargaining rights.
Oh.
Our individual bargaining rights in 1940. In other words,
38-97 strike. Oh,
yeah.
I thought maybe you meant the
no,
salmon
we never
handlers.
Had any. We never had a strike at all. But we had to conform to the strikes that were in 36 and 37 on the waterfront. We didn't do any work. But we did some little help to them on picket duty in Seattle when we wanted our own bargaining rights. And so that's how, I think that was in the spring of 40, if I remember right. And then after that, they, being no work here, where they needed some men, they just absorbed us or transferred us over.
So you came into longshoring full-time right at the beginning of the war.
Oh, well, it was...
Well, the war was going to begin before
yeah,
too long.
Well, it's, it was a year, about 14 months before the war started, but we were working, whatever work there was.
Was there much
oh,
in 40?
Not that much. But we'd managed to make a living.
What were the war years like on the waterfront? Now, I know the military came in, late in the war, 44, 45, the Navy came in and took over the port piers for a while for their work.
Well, the thing of it was that the first of the war, up until, oh, I would say 10 months after the war started, it didn't start booming around here until they started shipping. I was over in the shipyards along with some of the others because there wasn't enough work up at the hall. So there was a number of them went over at the shipyards as riggers, and we worked there until they recalled us, and then we stayed on the waterfront.
When did the war boom sort of really start? Was that 41 before you really started getting a lot of
well,
longshore
it was,
work?
No, it was actually, wasn't the December 7th in 41, the war?
Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor, well, it actually wasn't until 42 that the actual, I would say, anywhere from 6 months after the war started until it got to the point where they needed us.
So is the majority of the work you did during the war directly related to the military, loading military supplies, or?
Well, we also had general cargoes, but I think the majority of it was, there used to be a lot of food stuff and things going over to Russia from Schaefer too. They had quite a bit of that in there. Mm-hmm. I know they used to have cases of fatbacks that went over there.
On Russian ships or on American?
On Russians. Mm-hmm. And then they'd also send flour and other things to over there. It was just a lot of the things went to, I think it was the port of Vladivostok.
Excuse me.
And then there was also other military, well, they used to have the a base over at the port here where a lot of the longshoremen went, and then they had one out there, I think, where Clover Park Vocational School is, the old airport. They had buildings out there where they had Navy things and Army things, or vice versa.
Staging area.
Staging areas for the different things. Mm-hmm. And then they also had their local work here, but there were a lot of them that worked out at the bases. Mm-hmm. And then I left in 45. I went in the service. I went in the CBs for just a
Is
short
that by
time.
Choice?
Yes, I, well, for some reason or other, I had itchy feet, you might say, to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And then after I got back, I worked for a few years and had a divorce and so everything. Then I just kind of was footloose and fancy free for about 8 years. And I came back here in 1955. In September.
So you worked San Francisco?
No, I was down around Pasadena, but I didn't work the waterfront down there. Uh-huh. No, I could have, but I just didn't get down in there. I'm kind of glad in a way I didn't. In a way, maybe I'm not, I don't know. Never know in this life. And then when I got back, I kept steady, plugging at it pretty steady.
Well, when during the before 45, before you left, was there were there problems getting enough people to work the docks? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of young men being in the, you know, most of them being in the Army and stuff, and also,
well,
the attraction maybe of the shipyards, which was real steady work.
Well,
you know,
like,
good
I
pay
think there
and
was
stuff.
Quite an influx of personnel from the Midwest that came out here. Mm-hmm. And we probably got our share of them. And to a certain degree, there were a lot of the older fellows that
weren't eligible for the Army.
Weren't eligible for the Army that came on the waterfront. I know that in the research that I did on the widows here, where I noticed some of the husbands were up in age when they started on the waterfront. So
now, one of the books I read said, well, they were using San Francisco as an example, and said that during the war, that there is now a large, well, in this is in the 60s, because the book was about the M&M agreement. They said at the time the M&M agreement was signed, there was just, I mean, the vast majority of union members were people in their, you know, even 50s and 60s who had started during the war when they were in their 40s.
Yes, you know, there was that.
That one of the reasons longshoring traditionally has been seen as sort of an older man's job, you know, is because you, from the 40s on, you had this large body of older men who had started during the war.
Well, there were a lot of the younger fellows. These are the majority of the younger fellows were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember right, it don't seem to me like there was too much of a priority, or when I mean a I don't know just how to put it, whether it was a you see, they had the draft at that time. Now, whether they were exempt from the draft on the waterfront, that
because it was considered defense work.
Well, at first it wasn't, so it was kind of a, seemed to me like that's the way it was. It's a long.
Now, shipyard work was exempt work.
Exempt. If you quit there, they'd put you in the army. I know.
Right. So I suppose a young man would be more likely to want to go to the shipyards where he'd be exempt.
Well, there was a certain.
Possibly be drafted if he didn't want to be.
But I know there was a number of, as I say, migration from the Midwest and the South, Southwest,
mm-hmm.
out to the coast, because that was a place that seemed to be the busiest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about women during World War II?
Well, you had the women working in the shipyards, but I don't remember of the waterfront ever having any women.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Russian ships used to have women on them. They used to have 3-4 women or more on them. I know one time I was when I was a night foreman at Schaefer 1, I turned around, they were loading a cement ship up at Commercial Dock with flour. And I didn't have too much to do, so I took a walk up there, and there was a Russian woman down there checking the flour as it came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, oh, you're a checker. And she thought I said a chippy. And oh, boy.
Language barriers can
yeah,
be embarrassing.
It but it was resolved anyway. But that's what they used to do a lot of, is they have the Russian women on there checking the cargoes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in World War I and the Civil War after the Revolution, they had lost most of their men. They just didn't have any men left to do work. I mean, they had some. But. Now, what about, I get the impression from some of the reading I've done and a lot of the other guys I've talked to that during the war, a lot of it at the impetus of the Army and the other military was when you really started to see more machinery being brought in and developed.
Yes. It was... I can remember when I was working at Schaefer 2, when the Russian cargo was coming in, the Army put in lift trucks.
Mm-hmm.
They had a couple of tow motors that they brought in, because Schaefer Dock had one of the first Clark lift trucks that was about a block long. That you stood up on the back and everything was in the front, and then all of it was forward of that.
Yeah.
They had one of the first ones. I know I drove that.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was over there working on the salmon, we used to get on that once in a while and just kind of fool around with it. Well, Charlie Neudorfer was one that was the foreman over there, and he was a swell guy. He's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get an interview with him?
No, his name hasn't come up. I'll jot it down. Did they start using lift trucks in the hold during the war, or was that after?
Very, very seldom. It was mostly on the dock where I was at. I stayed at Schaefer 2 there on the Russian cargo for quite a long time.
You were in a preferred gang?
No. We'd just go over there. And then I turned around and I happened to go over to Schaefer 1 one night. And they used to take the supervisors or their checkers and use them as a foreman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I raised particular hell about no lights in cars and just a supervisor over there, no foreman. They were loading boxcars and they had no lighting facilities. And I says, this is a pretty cheap outfit when they turn around and just hire supervisors for foremen. I says, can't they, well, I better not say that. Can't they turn around and hire a foreman to look after this situation? Next afternoon, I get a telephone call. Winnie Hopkins wants to see you. So I go down to Schaefer 1, talk to Winnie. What's on your mind? He says, how would you like the night foreman's job here? I says, well, I'll tell you. I'll take the night foreman's job if it's at foreman's pay and not supervisor's pay. I says, I'm too young a man to get in trouble with the union. Okay. Well, at that particular time, they had two different rates for foremen. They had the head foreman rate, and then they had the assistant foreman rate. So they put me on as the assistant foreman, but I was night foreman there for, year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Until I decided that it's kind of getting on my nerves a little.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had so much work that you were supposed to do. You see, all this equipment was coming back from Alaska, and they were dispersing it to wherever the Major Baxter was down there. And wherever they got orders to send it, that's where they would load it out, or maybe to be put on trucks, but the majority of it was put in boxcars. I know we used to get a lot of beer bottles back. And then there was a lot of gasoline barges, aviation gas, and barrels, empty barrels would come back. And that was more or less of a depot for returning cargo from Alaska, Schaefer 1.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the Air Force at Baker Dock, which was the next door. So they had a lot of men working.
But the military had leased out the docks for the duration of the war?
Well,
or they had just contracted with Schaefer and
Well,
Baker?
That I don't know what procedure, whether they leased it or whether it was just a stopping point and contracted by Schaefer Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Air Force leased Baker Dock. But as far as the other, I'm not positive.
So I know the Navy in 44, they just outright leased the whole port, you know, both 1 and 2.
Yeah,
just
I know.
Took them over, basically.
Yeah. So there was, that's where I was for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Then when did you come back and start more or less full time on the waterfront?
Well, I kept working there during from after the war, after about, got a divorce, I guess it was in 46. And I'd worked up until about 48 or 49. I was driving winch for a gang then.
Mm-hmm.
And, and then when I left, I just took off, forget it, for a while. I had, I was paying my dues up there, my brother was for me. And finally, about a month before I came back, he turned around and got me a withdrawal card, so I had to get back in. Well, no problem, but,
Bad timing.
And then they had the, about that time in 55, 56, they had the dew line cargo that went up to Alaska on that dew line. All towers and all that was coming into to Pier 1. We'd work in Pier 2. We'd work in the warehouse. I'd work wherever I could. I was mostly on all equipment, lift trucks.
Do you remember, the ILWU had one strike after the war. It was either 46 or...
49.
48, somewhere in
48
there,
or 49.
Where they came down, like, with airplanes and
well,
and
I wasn't
boats
here at that
and all
time.
That stuff. You were gone
here
by then?
That's when they were playing the record, the Woody Woodpecker song.
Or something, yeah,
yeah,
but they came down, they would actually get out in their little motor boats with their signs, you know, asking you guys to...
Yeah, well, they had their own bargaining rights here, so there was nothing they could do but work. They had the contract to work ships, and that's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then in 19, I was driving winch for a gang, and there was Chet Barker, I know Chet for quite a while. I happened to talk to Chet. He was in the gear locker for Grace. And he said there was that Seattle Stevedore was looking for somebody to be the gear locker here in Tacoma. So I said, oh, I wouldn't mind trying that. So he submitted my name, and I got a, he called me and he told me, he says, Mac wants to see you in Seattle, or call him up. Well, I'd been working pretty steady, so I thought, I'll just take a day off and go over to Seattle. So I went over and talked to McKinney at the gear locker. And that was about the 14th of October in 1961. And so he showed me around, introduced me around to the different ones, talking. He said, well, you want the job? I said, I'll tackle it. So the first job I had was the 16th of October. I never had any day off till I quit again. But I started it in 61, down in Schaefer Dock. And had a little cubby hole that was about the size of this room where I'd put some gear. I didn't have much. And then I got a little bigger place. And then finally they moved over to Thorn Road. And then when the plastic outfit that was making gallon jugs over there wanted more room, they bought this other place, but I'd already gone. Mm-hmm. But I was the one that started the plastic jugs on the waterfront in Tacoma. Because one day I was over to Schaefer Dock with my gear, and I run across, they used to have these 2 gallon milk cans, and they used to punch a hole with a hook or something on both, one on each side, right close to the top, just where it came over before you got to the neck. That's how they'd pour their water out. But 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't have any cups. They didn't have cups, they'd drink right out of the lid. Mm-hmm. So whether a guy chewed snooze or not didn't make any difference. Well, anyway, I run across 4 buckets in a box, and they were so rusted up you could never clean them up. It's just one of the things that I'd overlooked, and being new.
Excuse me, just a minute.
So then I couldn't. Oh, I cleaned them up, but they would always be a rust spot in the different ones. You'd use steel wool, and once the finish inside was scratched, why then you could expect rust. And so I called up Mac in Seattle, and I says, have you got anything over there that I could use that won't rust? He says, well, I've got some plastic gallon jugs over here, but they refuse to use them here. I says, send them over. So I went up, but I think Alec Guinness was in the office as a business agent. And I went up to him and I said, listen, I says, I've got some gallon jugs here. I says, can we use them on the waterfront? He says, I don't see why not. So that's how the gallon jugs got started. And then if they came in over here from Seattle, how come we can't get plastic jugs over here? They were, a lot of them, like Olympia, would use glass gallon wine bottles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some of them, they would put them in a case or something and fix something for them. But we had the plastic jugs, and I think they run, we could get them for around 35 cents against $4.50 for the other. So that's how you got your plastic jugs on the waterfront.
Well, I'm sure it was a health improvement, if not more convenient.
Then you got the cups after that too. Mm-hmm. And So it worked out pretty good, and if you punched a hole in it, you weren't out much. Yeah. Whereas a lot of times the longshoremen, if the can just had a little rust spot in them, they'd just take and punch holes in the bottom of it.
So it couldn't be used anymore.
Well, then they'd use them for nail cakes,
yeah,
or nails for the ship. Well, you could do the same with the with a plastic one. Just cut out a little of the top, dump nails in, you had a handle. Oh, it worked out pretty good.
Do you remember in the years just before 61, when the first M&M agreement was signed, how, by that time, how widespread was the use of machinery? And by that time, forklifts were pretty common. I mean,
the docks and everything, and they were, the stevedore companies were starting to get the lift trucks and utilize them in the holds of the ship, because they found out that the airspace that they left came back the same way as it left.
Mm-hmm.
There were no problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it was faster, and if you could get palletized cargo, very fast. And at that time, then they used what they called a robot. Remember when the first one came in? You turn around, you have the two places on top to hook it up. Go in and out the same way.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't turn. And you turn around, and if it was palletized, the lift truck could put it on the robot. A lift truck on the dock could take it off. Very, very fast in comparison to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the time that they started utilizing the mechanization.
Mm-hmm. What was the general reaction to people in Tacoma when the first discussions around the M&M agreement began and stuff? Were people fearful about losing work if they gave in terms of mechanization, or?
Well, they didn't. I don't think actually that the majority understood the mechanization. This is my opinion, outside of the ones that negotiated the contract. They could give you a little of the concept of it, but I don't think that the longshoremen themselves actually were too familiar. The thing that they were looking at, in my estimation, was the dollars that might be obtained when, if you retired under that
mm-hmm.
mechanization.
Mm-hmm.
Because until I started reading this book on mechanization that I got from the from UCLA, I didn't realize how much that the longshoremen actually lost of the gains that they'd made over the years.
Yeah, in terms of work rules and,
yeah, well,
and
the,
that kind of stuff,
man,
there was an amazing amount of stuff just given,
yes,
sold basically for however
and,
many millions
and
of dollars that fund
it
was.
Even stated in the book that they can't understand how a smart negotiator like Harry Bridges turned around and gave away so much.
In the one book that I was reading, the guy used the caucus notes as his basis for determining how the union made its decisions, you know, and came up with the mechanization agreement. And basically the approach that Bridges was taking in the caucus, I don't know what, you know, he was saying at union meetings to the rank and file in general, but basically the approach he was taking in the caucus is that we can't fight mechanization. It's sort of, it's too big, it's inevitable, and so we're going to have to just, you know, sort of cut our losses in effect. And he's, and it, in fact, I was struck by some of the things that he said sounding almost like what you would expect the employer to say to you. you know, when the employer's coming and asking for you to give up things in order, you know, to get something back, you know, to or to at least to keep your job, right? Listen, if you want to keep your job, you're going to have to give up this, this, and this. And in this, in essence, it seemed like that's sort of the approach Bridges was taking. He said, look, there's nothing we can do about mechanization. We can't stop it. You know, we're just going to, you know...
You might just as well gain by it.
You know, we might just as well gain by it, but his approach, and it seems like what the M&M agreement ended up doing, is what you gained, or at least what the men who were current, who were working at the time, what they gained was this amount of money, but what they lost, and what, which means that the guys who are out there working now have lost it also, you know, was were all these work rules, all these various things that were designed to, you know, for safety reasons, or to keep, you know, the level of employment.
Yeah.
And I was just a little, I mean, I've never, I've not experienced another union that I have studied this closely that gave up so much, it seems.
Well, the thing of it was, as I say, that amount of monies, you see, this is one thing that I couldn't understand. I can remember Bridges coming up to the hall, and he stood on that podium up there, and he made the statement that in the future years, mechanization, the amount of monies that you will get back from mechanization or your M&M will be unlimited. And then right away in 71, they chopped that off.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to the, well, you might say they pacified the retirees with what they call a bridge by retiring at 62. Instead of waiting until you were 63 or 65, and gave them that $100 bridge for the 3-year period or whatever.
Well, it was the guys in 66 were the last ones to get that big lump sum.
They got the under the 66 contract that was ratified in July, I think, of 1966. They got around $13,000.
But they were the last ones to get that big chunk.
That's the only one. Yeah, the others got around 7 or 8 or whatever it was. But then we also received around $1,200 each member on the coast of monies that was left. I think it was from the 60...
It was from the wage guarantee fund,
It was something of that nature. But then, another thing, as far as the that wage guarantee, I don't think that we've ever used it in Tacoma. Maybe the foremen have used it, but I don't think the membership in Tacoma has ever...
Well, I've been told it's never been used here.
Here, but I think that in San Francisco it would have been used.
And I know in L.A. it's been used.
I think that that's one of the poorest things that they could ever turn around and put in a contract, because any time you're going to guarantee anybody anything, you're going to have to take away something to make that guarantee work. And I have never been in favor of a guaranteed wage. I think that if they were to turn around and contribute it more to fringe benefits, I think you would be further ahead with your working men. Of course, there's a lot of people that are a lot smarter than I am that are figuring out these contracts. If I was that smart to be able to figure a contract, I'd probably be working for the employer in another way. But
well, do you think that there was an alternative to giving up all the work rules and stuff?
Well, It just kind of reminds me of the, to a certain degree, even when I first started on the waterfront, that the there was still that feeling of the employer owning everything. There still was that feeling on the waterfront, where they would turn around, you might have to put a dollar in a snooze can and send it up to the boss in order to get picked on the next job. It gave me that, they had that old kind of a trend, you might say. And it gradually, as the newer men got in it, they got away from that. You didn't talk back to the boss because you'd never get hired again. And it got to the point where sometimes I think it's gotten out of hand. Mm-hmm. You can tell the boss whatever you think and he can't fire you. And I think it's gone the other way. And when the employer owned everything, he had control over you completely. But it got to the point where the longshoremen over the years were starting to get control of the employer, and so therefore they had smart lawyers and smart men at the head that could turn around and outthink the ordinary working man, and so therefore that's probably in a roundabout way how they got rid of a lot of their work rules. Mm-hmm. Or whatever they want to call it, whatever, and when their safety or whatever it was that they lost. Mm-hmm. This is the way I look at it. And now that actually they have got a pretty good hand in this right now.
The employers, you mean? Yeah.
Of course, it's got to the point where you can talk now. You can negotiate. And a lot of it can be resolved through negotiations. Where before, it was a bullheaded situation, we're going on strike, we're going to do this and we're going to do that.
So, but you think that partly because of the M&M and stuff, that the longshoremen have lost some control over their work?
Well, maybe to a certain degree. There are certain ways to do certain jobs that you're going to be the most efficient methods. And 9 times out of 10, if you...
Come in.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine.
You know who that is?
Now, how far are you coming to this day and age?
We're coming right up to the, you know, the last day the book is written. Hopefully it'll say something about, you know, what's going on at the time. Yeah. I mean, we're trying to bring it right up to...
I just gave her some of the your transfer card.
All my information I really give to Bill Bridges.
Uh-huh.
And I was the chairman of the interchange of gangs when they first started that. In Tacoma, there was 5 of us. We met with a group from Seattle, and there was more than 5 in Seattle. I don't recall how many there was. George Block was the chairman of the Seattle group.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we still belonged to the IBL.
Right.
And there
was about 53, is that?
54, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong on that. You might be right. And after that, I was Puget Sound Council, and then I was on the area committee, which is a thankless job. That was at the time when they had this conformance performance bullshit.
Oh, before the M&M was signed in 61.
Yeah. And that was a pain in the neck.
In what way?
That's your transfer card. you wanted to look at it.
Oh. That was a real pain in the ass, if there ever was one, because they had some of the most ridiculous things going on at that time. And that is, I'm speaking of the area now. And there were so many things that were disagreeable. Meeting at the gangplank, you know, and turning to by the foreman and all this rot, you know, and you had to take a leak. Why, if you was a winch driver, they could can the gang and all this and that rot. It was stunk up the joint. Nobody really liked it. And
Some of the books I've read, it said they basically, those conformist performance programs never worked either.
Oh, no. There was a pain in the neck, and that was on the area at the time. And so, Jesus, we run into them things. And area, are you familiar with the area committee?
Yeah.
All right, then you know more about it than I did. But anyway, I represented this area and the harbor and Olympia. And it wasn't just a coma that had this here. Everybody had this. Everybody, you know, for no particular reason whatsoever. If the foreman or if the superintendent, for any particular reason, wanted to shut the job down, well, they'd shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're you get.
Yeah, sure. We have to record. I can't remember all this stuff.
I'll have to tell you that. In my tenure as a longshoreman, actually the most important thing that I ever heard was not on the waterfront. It was connected with the waterfront. It was I was riding a bus. I was going to Arizona, and the wife and I, and the man in the seat in front of us, I got pretty chummy with him, and we got to talking. And he was the mayor of Seattle in 1934 during the strike.
Oh yeah.
His name was Charlie Smith.
Right.
And it would just have to be my word against somebody else's word, you know.
Sure.
And anyway, he didn't know I was a longshoreman. I suppose he suspected as much, because I did. I probably undoubtedly wearing a white cap. But I had quite a long conversation, and he was actually apologizing for the calling out the guard, you know, and there was, you might say, as far as professional people is concerned, they considered it to be on the order of a kind of an insurrection going on the waterfront. And prior to Dave Beck's departure from, and he was in, he was probably responsible just as much as anybody else for Charlie Smith being mayor. You know, he had to have the support of labor. So when Dave Beck left for California, it seemed to me it was in Oakland, California. He told Charlie, you keep me up posted on any developments and so forth. And so when things were starting to get a little bit hairy, then they had Charlie called Dave, and they both agreed that things was getting out of hand, that they better call out the guard. Now this, of course, it would be real interesting to consult with Dave Beck and get his opinion on that.
Yeah, well, I have his home phone number. So.
And you would just kind of, work this in, you know.
Why do you think Beck would want? Did he feel that the rank and file were getting out of control of the leadership?
Dave Beck, at no time did Dave Beck ever support any other union. It was either Teamsters or nobody. This is my own personal opinion. I think you'll find that there's a lot of people that'll agree with my opinion, that whatever was good for the Teamsters, that was good for Dave Beck also. So anything that didn't have anything to do with the Teamsters, like in the waterfront, for example, why he felt as though he was indirectly connected to that. And he was one of those that would operate behind the scenes, you know. But the history.
Well, he was in on that one agreement that was the June 18th or whatever agreement that Ryan and he and Michael Casey in San Francisco put together.
And that was the one where it wasn't too well thought of.
No, it was rejected overwhelmingly, as but, I recall.
Yeah, this is that. But the history of Dave Beck is that way. Anything that wasn't absolutely. Connected with the Teamsters, why he was 100% Teamster and nothing for anybody else, in my opinion. And he tried to organize the Boeing workers and things like this here, but his history is sorted as far as.
Well, at Boeing, he crossed picket lines. To
oh yes, definitely. He did the same thing here. They organized. They broke the. The brewery workers strike here at Maranoff, for an example, it killed one guy. I don't remember his name. He lived on McKinley Hill on Martin Street there. Nice guy. But anyway, the brewery workers there were, I don't remember their exact name, but anyway, they were considered brewery workers, but they also drove the trucks, and this is what Dave Beck objected to. So they threw picket lines around there, organized them. Drive and so forth, and beat hell out of quite a few guys, and they finally did organize. They broke the brewery workers, and so installed their own style of brewery employees, and so these here, that's the result of that strike, and that goes back quite a few years.
Now, you were on the area committee before the M&M. Were you involved in the M&M negotiations?
No. No, I wasn't. But that was an impossible situation for just about everybody concerned. Nobody was winning on this here. I got notes on that thing, and the notes I can hardly very faintly recall some of the incidents. And so if I was to quote this here, give you them there, you wouldn't really get that much benefit out of them, because I can't hardly recall myself.
So you're not sure that sort of selling off working conditions was worth it? The amount of money people got, or
you on the mechanization part of it?
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm not. No, I think it all wound up all right. The only trouble is that the two parties couldn't get together, and you know this is going from one extreme to another extreme. You understand? But as far as the mechanization, it eventually turned out real good, because in lots of cases you couldn't justify manpower on the mechanization program. It's quite difficult to do. What are you going to do with these men? You just can't stand them around. But in the long haul, it turned out real good, real good. You wound up with more manning before it was all over, with more men involved before it was over with. But it was such a long range program, and it was such a giant step in that one direction. It was hard for both parties actually to swallow.
How did the rank and file thing? Frank was saying that he wasn't sure that at the time people really understood what the M&M agreement was about or meant. And that, you know, he didn't really realize a lot of the things that were given up in terms of working conditions until after he read a book some years later. Do you think that was true, that it was sort of so new or complicated or something that people really didn't understand the details?
There was a lot of misunderstanding on both sides. On both sides. The interpretations on both sides is altogether different.
Especially that coffee break.
I don't remember the thing about coffee breaks. What?
Well, they had a 15-minute coffee break in the contract. But they wouldn't allow them to take a unit coffee break. In other words, a gang couldn't take a coffee break. They wanted an individual to go and take his coffee break, and when he left, another one, after he came back, another one would turn around.
Mm-hmm.
And it took quite some time before they broke that unit and got the unit break as they have it today, the whole ship.
Why do you think the employers just didn't want to stop production for 15 minutes?
Well, just stop and figure out a half an hour a day, how much can be accomplished in a half an hour a day if the production doesn't stop.
Yeah. But doesn't that, wouldn't it present to have one person leave for 15 minutes? I'm trying to think, is in terms of like if you have, you know, you have a gang and it's that size for a reason because there are a certain number of jobs that have to go on. And if one person leaves for 15 minutes so that you have one person less, you know, than you're supposed to, would that create safety problems? Or,
well,
or like what do you do when it's the wench driver's turn to take his break?
Then they can. We, there's many cases documented of that when I was on the area. And again, a guy would leave and go on coffee break, and the foreman would immediately can the gang. He wouldn't even look down the hole to see whether the work had ground to a complete halt or not. If possibly it did, possibly it didn't. I wouldn't say nine chances, but there's a good chance the work continued, but the gangs were still canned. Right on the spot, especially if it, and also if a deck man, left, that was the end of that.
And
they never, at the peculiar part of this, sometime it was, a deck man wasn't even required. It was a good time for him to leave. The men were working. They had enough work down there. There was piling dunnage or doing any one of a hundred things that they could be doing down there without the assistance of a deck man. You wouldn't need a deck man, wouldn't be required until they wanted to hoist, as long as they didn't want to hoist. But they never would look down the hole. They just can you indiscriminately right there. And that's the, we had beef. There's one right here. Well, I wouldn't say the one, but this, we had a lot of that, all mm-hmm. kinds of that. And that was there, that was a big bone of contention, and we generally won those beefs. I wouldn't say we generally won. Actually, it was on the area, it was a half and half type of a thing, you know. Now it's your turn. Next time it's my turn. No, that type of a thing, so it won't look too lopsided, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We won beefs we shouldn't have, and beefs we lost we shouldn't have.
Now, after the 61 agreement was signed, and, you know, the sling load and manning and all that stuff was changed, how much did the employers attempt to take advantage of that, to really, to push people harder than they should, to speed them up and take advantage of the new,
Well, there's no, one man can only do one man's work. He ain't gonna do two man's work. He can't replace another man. That's all he can do. It's just replace him, but he can't replace one and a half men or two men. It's impossible. Mm-hmm.
But did the employers try? Were there some who pushed, you know, sort of the limits of the thing, or?
No, we never had a quota as far as the cargo was concerned, either coming or going. We never had a quota system, but naturally the more work you done, the more they wanted done. It's that simple. And if ground the thing around to a halt, of course, then they would can.
When the M&M came in, you were still in the gear locker?
Yes.
So you really weren't out on the ship and
I was working the ship when the M&M came in. I didn't get in the gear locker until October of 61.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you told me that, right.
But the way the M&M, it created a problem as far as load limits went.
I give all my records to Bill Bridges, and these here are just kind of but here's one for an example. Important, if a deck man goes to the toilet, the whole gang can be fired, and that was Cornell, who was the employer's representative at the area committee, and the date was September 15th, 1959.
What was the deck man supposed to do if he had to go to the bathroom?
I guess he was supposed to have a portable potty. I don't know what the hell he was supposed to do. But this was at an area meeting. This mm-hmm. is the way it came out. I wish I had the exact minutes of that, but I didn't. Like I say, I turned them over to Bill Bridges. Mm-hmm. And then I had moved, and so I lost a lot of things. But this is one of them. See, I've got a lot of these.
So when containers first started coming into this port was not till 70 or so, was it? I mean, in any...
It was around during 69, because when I quit the gear locker, I turned around and started driving straddle carrier over here at Pier 4.
Mm-hmm.
I drove that old Clark, and I continued to drive that. And in the last 5 years prior to my retirement, I was on straddle carriers most of the time.
But when you first started, how many strads did they have?
They only had the Clark.
Just the one.
And then they got two Germans that came in, the Piners.
Mm-hmm. And what were they using? They didn't have regular container cranes, did they? To unload the containers in the beginning.
They didn't have the container cranes. They would use, they had some whirlies that they would use. And about the only one that was in here was American Mail Line at that time. And they used to store a lot of empty containers here, so we could use lift trucks to lift the empty containers.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have a lift truck that was big enough for containers until later on. Then mm-hmm. they started getting the larger lift trucks.
Mm-hmm.
But the Clark was here for the longest. They used that for a number of years until it got to the point where it wouldn't hoist level and it was breaking down. And then they started using the Germans, the Piners. The only problem with the Piners, in my estimation, was that you were too far off to the side.
Oh, they're the ones where the cab is,
was on the side.
Over on the side, yeah.
And there's also the chance, well, take a chance on any of them. It don't make any difference when you go under the cranes. It was always a bone of contention about the crane operators and the straddle carrier drivers.
When containers first started coming in any quantity, did you have any particular problems about jurisdiction over who was going to stuff and unstuff, or had that been settled by that time?
Well, that was settled here. They were stuffing and unstuffing here, and then they put the container station in at Pier 7B. But as the contract kept going, why, more and more trucks would come in for empty containers and load them. And finally, I guess Pacific Storage got their own container station down below. Mm-hmm. And during the smelter strike, they stored a lot of copper. Pacific Storage stored a lot of copper. Well, we used to load the copper here at Pier 4, but we would have to shore it up. And Pacific Storage would load it uptown and bring it in, and there was hardly any shoring in it. So, in fairness to the longshoremen, they would have to spend extra time and more monies to load a container than they would up there. Of course, I don't know what length of time it took them to load a container in comparison mm-hmm. to what the longshoremen could load it. But when you don't have to shore them up, I pretty near stood one on end to see if I could set the copper out on it one time. I jarred it and jiggled it and twisted it and started and stopped with it, but didn't shift. Of course, those bars are pretty heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can remember one time talking about copper bars. The boys, we used to have to pack them by hand, two men. You'd build a little table and you'd pick them up and you'd take them, put them wherever they had to go, wherever you were stowing them. Well, this particular time it was a certain gang. They took a two-wheel truck down in the hole to land the copper on so that they could run the whole load over to where they were going to stow it. And they were hanging the hook on the other side, so the boss turned around and dropped one right on the two-wheeler, just smashed it all to pieces, so they'd have to pack. But eventually they got to where that was the forerunner of the two-wheelers that they used to get the big, and they'd have a big deal on it, and heavy, and you could run that right to your pile, and you could stow it twice as fast.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the
forerunner. Well, seems to me the boss would want you to stow it twice as fast. I mean,
But then when you turn around and only one side was, you see, you had two sides of the ship, and one side was hanging the hook on the other one, and
yeah.
And that didn't work.
Yeah.
So they smashed it instead of interchanging.
Or giving them both.
Yeah, well, there was only one. Those two-wheel lift trucks, we used to call them. But I can remember trucking that flour down at Sperry Mill. Scotty Keir used to contract it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you'd get. You'd get those two-wheel trucks and you'd have a nice shiny blade on there, no marks, because if you tore a sack, you was up the road.
Yeah.
There was no monkeying around. There used to be a lot of flour trucked up there. Just about out of tape.
Yeah, I gotta change it.